From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai today. Major developments this week in Africa and the Caribbean. First, an update on the political crisis in Zimbabwe. It's a day short of 2 weeks since Zimbabweans went to the polls. The results of the presidential election still have not been released. President Robert Mugabe's party is talking about a runoff vote, but opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai says he won't take part in a second round. The delay is causing tension and anxiety. For the latest, NPR's Africa correspondent Ofabia Quist-Arkton joins us from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Hi, Ofabia.
Greetings.
There have been some developments over the last 24 hours. What's the latest now?
Indeed. In fact, even over the last few hours, what we're hearing, and this really is hot off the presses, I haven't even been able to confirm it, is that the opposition, Morgan Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change, is calling for a strike next week. I'm told that leaflets are being handed around town saying that there should be a strike next week, and this is clearly in protest at the delay in the release of the presidential elections. The High Court, by the way, the judge who is hearing the opposition's petition to have these results released urgently, is meant to be ruling on Monday.
Do you know why we hadn't gotten the results before now?
Tony, if I knew that, I would be a very wealthy woman. You know, it depends who you talk to. On the government side, they're saying there has to be meticulous, and this is the word we keep hearing, meticulous verification of the results. The government party, President Mugabe's ZANU-PF, has also alleged irregularities and misconduct in how the vote was carried out. And in fact, some election officials have even been arrested, apparently for undercounting up to 5,000 votes in Mugabe's favor. If you talk to the opposition, they're saying that the authorities are delaying the release of the outcome of the presidential vote because they are mounting a campaign of violence, of intimidation, and trying to stoke up fear amongst the people because they say there's going to be a runoff. The election, the opposition says it won outright in the first round. So it depends who you speak to. And the election commission, the very body that's meant to give the results, isn't talking at all.
Well, Fabia, I understood that there was to be some sort of meeting in Zambia this weekend to try to resolve the crisis, but something has happened to change who may and may not attend that meeting. What can you tell us about that?
What we definitely know is that the Southern African Development Community, SADC, has called an emergency meeting of its leaders. It's a 14-member grouping, including Zimbabwe. At first, we thought that President Robert Mugabe would be attending, but state radio here in Harare has said that he won't be going. And then you can sort of look at that different ways. Is that because he is waiting for the region to decide what it feels it has to do to resolve the situation, or is he going to speak to them from abroad? But we're told that Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader, will be going there, and his views are very, very clear. The region is clearly worried. Zimbabwe is a country in economic meltdown. And of course, because unemployment is so high, inflation running at way over 100,000%, it's the neighbors that are having to take the influx of Zimbabweans, of course, looking for a better life, looking for jobs. They are the ones who are dealing with the exiles and the migrants. But the question is, and the question many Zimbabweans are asking is, what is this regional grouping going to do? When last year, President Mugabe's security forces bashed, and that's the word he used, bashed the opposition so that opposition supporters had to go to hospital, President Mugabe went off to a regional meeting in Tanzania, and virtually nothing was said, and he came out looking pretty gleeful. So Zimbabweans want the region to act, and the opposition wants these regional leaders to tell President Mugabe, you lost this poll, it's time for you to go. You're 84, an honorable, graceful exit is what you should be considering, but we'll have to see what they decide.
To follow up on that last question, Ofabia, if Mugabe refuses to leave office and if the results show that he in fact did lose the election, what can and will foreign countries or agencies do, do you think, in terms of trying to get him to step down?
Tony, we haven't even got to that stage yet. The government is saying that no one candidate got more than 50 plus 1% of the vote, so there's going to be a runoff vote. The opposition is saying it won outright. The Election Commission is not announcing results. So this is a catch-22. We can't even get to those possibilities. But certainly the outside world is concerned. Britain, the former colonial power, and President Mugabe absolutely vilifies London and Washington, says that they are meddling in Zimbabwe's internal affairs. But they are concerned. And most people are saying the most important thing is that the will of the Zimbabwean people who went to vote must be respected. But until there is an election result, whether President Mugabe won or lost, the fact is they say there's going to be a runoff. Until we know for sure, until there's something definitive from the Election Commission, everything is in limbo.
NPR Africa correspondent Ofebia Quist-Arkton speaking with us from Harare, Zimbabwe. Ofebia, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
And now to Haiti, where things are settling down after 3 days of rioting in the capital, Port-au-Prince. A huge rise in food prices drove thousands of protesters and looters to riot earlier this week. UN troops moved in to protect parts of the capital. Meanwhile, President René Préval has begged for calm. Haiti is considered to be the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and the unrest over a crippled economy may not be easy to squelch. Mara Schiavo-Campo is in Port-au-Prince right now. She is a digital correspondent for NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams. Mara, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
You've been in the streets reporting on this story. What have you seen in terms of tension and unrest there?
Today, things are good. Public transportation is running. People are out doing their business, shopping. We went out, no roadblocks, no trouble at all. I can't say the same for the last few days. Yesterday was manageable. There were a few roadblocks, car fires, things like that, but it felt like the fire was dying down, so to speak. The last few days before that, things were very tense. Just coming in from the airport, we hit about a dozen roadblocks, burning tires, dumpsters, trash, with mobs of people that would come around the car. Our cameraman was sitting in the front with the window rolled down, and a man approached him with a huge stone, a stone he had to hold with both hands, and then it hit him with it, and our driver had to talk him out of it. So it was very tense earlier, and I imagine that it was like that in other parts of the country as well.
High food prices have become a global issue, but it seems worse in Haiti. Why is that?
Because it's such a poor country. As you mentioned in your intro, it's the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day. So when you have food prices that increase 50% in 1 year, that's going to be felt a lot more by people who are already really poor. This is a crisis of food affordability, not availability. It's not that the food isn't here. It's that people can't afford it. Here, it's not that they're broke. They can't eat because they have no reserves to go to. They have no discretionary income. So this is really a matter of survival for them.
Well, what is the government proposing to fix the problem?
Well, the thing is that the people were pretty clear about what they wanted to hear from the government. They wanted some government reshuffling. Some people were calling for Préval's resignation. Other people wanted the head of the prime minister. And people wanted to see, most importantly, an immediate reduction on food prices, something that maybe for the next 3 months prices would be cut. I mean, they wanted to see a difference right away. And they got neither. The president made a speech asking for calm. He obviously didn't step down. He didn't make any big changes in the government. He offered food subsidies for farmers, which I guess will help in the future, but it's not an immediate effect, it's not going to be felt immediately by the people in the street. So we'll see, you know, what happens with that, because I think people are hopeful that more change is coming, and so perhaps that's why things have calmed a little bit.
What about the possibility of an exodus toward the United States? I know that the UN, the U.S. Coast Guard is already on alert.
They are. You know, there are reports that the Coast Guard is looking for people and thinking that perhaps they'll have more interdictions because of what's happening here. But you have to remember that what's happened in the last week has been people expressing their anger over an existing situation. So the situation hasn't gotten worse for them. They just got fed up enough for it that they decided to take to the streets. So far, the Coast Guard hasn't seen any increase in people that are leaving Haiti. They're just being cautious about it.
To follow that point, Mara, many of the capital city's roadblocks, as you've already indicated, have been removed, and apparently life, as you say, is beginning to get somewhat back to normal, at least compared to what it was like just a few days ago. But protesters have warned that if food prices do not come down, there could be more trouble, and estimates are that food costs are, in fact, not likely to drop soon. Is there a sense there that there's more unrest to come?
Yes, it would not be surprising to anyone if this were to flare up again. You get the sense that the country, the people, everyone's kind of holding their breath to see what's going to happen. This weekend, there's very important political events that are happening. There are senators who are calling for no confidence in the prime minister. The prime minister, you know, his black line is very short at this point. So maybe if he's replaced, it'll buy the government some time to say to people, look, we're doing things and we're making moves and changes so that people will settle down a bit. But if they get the sense that nothing is being done and their lives have not changed, we're going to be back to square one. And you get the sense that this is a very fragile calm.
Is there a sense there that the problem from the Haitians who you've spoken to, is this across the board or is it just the poorest people in Haiti and that there are some people there who are having no trouble buying and acquiring food, or is it almost everyone?
Well, here's the thing. The statistic is that 80% of the population lives in poverty and that more than half of the population lives in abject poverty, which means they're living on less than $1 a day. So the vast majority of the people here are being affected by this. I met people yesterday who subsist on cookies made of dirt, butter, water, and salt, because it's the cheapest thing that they can eat. I met a man who's eating 25 of them a day. When you see these quote-unquote cookies, they look like ceramic plates. They're like clay. So you cannot exaggerate how bad things are for the people here. But once that genuine kind of grassroots movement started and people got to the streets and started asking for political change, then you had a lot of people with other motivations coming on board. You have drug smugglers who don't like some of the restrictions that are being placed on commerce right now. You have Aristide supporters who want to see him come back in the country. So once it started from that genuine spark of the people's trouble, then you have other groups who are taking advantage of it and coming on board who want to stoke the flames so that they can have their political needs met as well. So at this point, it's a little bit of a mishmash.
Mara Schiavocampo is a digital correspondent for NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams. She joined me from her hotel room in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Mara, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Haitian protesters settle down for now, but how long will the calm last? And President Bush won't be pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq anytime soon, based on General David Petraeus's recommendations. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates and former Secretary of State Colin Powell are offering a different point of view. Those topics and more on today's Reporters Roundtable with Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, a contributing editor at the L.A. Times op-ed section, John Yearwood, a world editor at the Miami Herald, and Beth Fooey, who covers presidential politics for the Associated Press. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Tony.
Hi there. Hello, Tony.
Nice to have you with us. Let's begin with this. We just heard from fellow journalist Mara Schiavocampo, I always get her name wrong, who is actually in Haiti right now, and she talked about the problems that are occurring there. I want to follow that conversation up with the three of you along this line. More than half of the Haitian senators and much of the public is calling for the resignation of the prime minister and the U.S.-backed president, Rene Préval. Haitian rioters, as you know, tried to storm the presidential palace on Wednesday. John, is a leadership change in order here?
Well, Tony, a few months ago I was in Haiti, in which I met with both the prime minister and the president. I think at the time we were talking about the level of political stability that they had brought to the country. And since then, there has been an intended vote of no confidence in the prime minister that essentially failed. And my sense is that certainly the president will survive this. The prime minister, I'm not as sure. Clearly, as you know, the prime minister is the one who runs the day-to-day government. And he certainly has a lot to answer for. But as he has proven in the past, he's very politically skilled and cunning. And we may see those skills come into play again this time. What clearly that they have to do is to announce a package of remedies that would help get to the heart of this, which is an economic problem. And by the way, it's an economic problem we're not only seeing in Haiti, that we're seeing in a number of countries around Latin America and indeed around the world, as relates to the increase in food prices.
Absolutely. Well, Beth, along that line, we mentioned that the rioters tried to storm the presidential palace on Wednesday. Mara told us that things are calm for now, not knowing how long that calm will continue. Do you think that a coup is possible there?
Oh, gosh, I couldn't say for sure. I mean, we're looking at this on my beat from a domestic standpoint as presidential candidates are getting ready take over the reins here and looking at a very unstable situation in a lot of countries. What I find interesting is that the rising price of food is affecting populations everywhere. I mean, a place like Haiti, which is so especially poor, it's the most acute. But here in this country, it's starting to be a very common campaign issue that voters bring up on the campaign trail. Between the cost of food and the rising fuel prices, people are really starting to be priced out of just very basic necessities. And so we're seeing it in an acute way in a place like Haiti, which is a desperately poor environment, but it's also starting to creep into the conversation here.
It absolutely is. But Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, do you think it is going to creep into the conversation in such a way that the United States or the international community might, in fact, be more engaged in trying to bring a resolution to this, particularly or beginning with Haiti, let's say?
Well, I would like to think so, Tony, but I doubt it. I mean, Haiti has been so unstable for so long, and it frankly, you know, at its worst crisis, doesn't get a lot of coverage here, doesn't get a lot of political attention. Although this latest thing with you know, the food riots, I guess you call them, it's hard to ignore. I mean, people storming the palace. I mean, it kind of brings to mind the point that I think Bono, the rock star who's become a global activist, has said poverty is a great threat to global security, and you can really see it in Haiti. And I think it's going to happen. It's going to become at least a presidential campaign issue.
How soon, Beth, do you think we'll start really hearing more about this from the candidates, or have we begun to a little bit already?
Well, they talk a lot about the various environments around the world that are quite unstable, and I think that this is going to come up soon. I mean, the dedication to eradicating poverty is something that John Edwards talked a lot about on the campaign trail, and it's starting to be something that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are talking about more and more as well, as we are seeing the economic situation becoming quite dire, both around the world and here domestically. And just last week, Senator Clinton said she would create a new post in the cabinet, a poverty czar, if elected president next year. So it's definitely something that's very much on their minds and on their radar screens.
Well, let's talk about something that they are talking about quite a bit, the Iraq War. General David Petraeus spent 2 days in congressional hearings this week giving an update on U.S. progress in Iraq. In response to the general's outlook, the president said just yesterday that there would be no further reduction of troops in Iraq beyond those already set to take place in July. Here's the president.
General Petraeus says he'll need time to consolidate his forces and assess how this reduced American presence will affect conditions on the ground before making measured recommendations on further reductions. And I've told him he'll have all the time he needs.
Now, on the very same day that the president was making those comments, John, in direct contrast, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that he hopes that we are able to resume troop reductions after a 45-day pause.
I certainly hope, continue to hope, that conditions will allow us to remove more troops by year's end. That hope for a return on success is shared by the president, General Petraeus, Admiral Mullen, and the chiefs.
So, John, am I missing something here? What's going on?
Well, clearly a mixed message coming from the White House. The president has said all along, even going back to even before he was reelected, that he would listen to his generals on the ground, and he made that clear in the speech that he gave. Clearly, the Secretary of Defense either was not part of the conversation, or they wanted to send a message that they thought was important to a part of their constituency that says, well, for the families of service members, there will be a possibility that we will be resuming these drawdowns. But, you know, as with everything else, the president is the one who holds sway. And to whom do you listen and who do you believe, the president or the Secretary of Defense? Most people want to believe the president. But it's clearly a case where the Secretary of Defense needs to clear some of these speeches with the White House before he goes out and contradicts his boss.
Well, to make matters worse, Beth, Gates yesterday, or today I believe it was, tried to sort of clarify what he meant and suggest that he and the administration are all on the same page. And yet my reading of it, I don't know if you had an opportunity to hear him or not, was that he didn't clear anything up.
Well, it does seem a little bit unclear, doesn't it? It's two very very strong voices here, not quite saying the same thing, and they're probably working very quickly to try to get back on the same page, as you say. But it probably reflects a difference of opinion within the administration that you know the president wants to leave as much time and space for General Petraeus to make things happen on the ground there, but Secretary Gates can see another way to go, and perhaps it's a situation that's still being worked out. But the president has declared what he would like to do, and I would agree that that's the voice that is going to prevail ultimately.
For those people, Aaron, who are hoping to have the troops brought home sooner rather than later, the news that the president is going to reduce deployments from 15 months to 12 months. How good of good news is that?
How good of good news is what Bush's
the reduction from 15 to 12 months for the deployment? Is that you know, I suppose if you're there, 3 months is better than nothing, and yet on one hand you could make the argument that that's not a particularly significant change.
Yeah, it seems a bit of a token. You know, listen, I think that was kind of clear this week in Congress is that you know they're making the war. They're making this up as they go. There's no real measure for, you know, the point we can pull out. I think Barack Obama asked that question, well, how much democracy do we need to have in Iraq before we can leave? And the remark Bush made about I'm going to give the general all the time he needs, that sounds an awful lot like a blank check. And the blank check has been raised a lot this week in terms of how much this war is costing, and the Democrats and some Republicans have really been pushing that. So time is money, I mean, literally, for the soldiers over there. So I think that's just sort of a bone that's being thrown their way. And I really don't think, as been suggested by the differing views and you know between the President, Secretary of Defense, there's just no solid plan here.
All right, we're going to move on to another topic, but in case you are just now joining us, you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. With me on today's Reporters Roundtable are Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, whom we just heard, contributing editor at the LA Times op-ed section, John Yearwood, a world editor at the Miami Herald, and Beth Fooey, who covers presidential politics for the Associated Press. And Beth, I'm going to come to you with this. Let's talk about the Pennsylvania primary, which is closing in on us. In early March, Hillary Clinton had nearly a double-digit lead in the Keystone State over Obama. How are those numbers looking now?
Well, the polls have definitely shown a tightening in Pennsylvania, which is really to be expected. Her lead of about, as you said, about 22 points shortly after the last round of primaries in early March was certainly not sustainable. I mean, Barack Obama has clearly done very well in states where he spends time campaigning, and he is now campaigning there. His campaign is running a lot of advertising on television and radio. He's a very big presence in Pennsylvania. So it was inevitable that the polls were going to tighten up, and I don't think that came as much of a surprise to anybody. Now, that said, whether he can close on Hillary Clinton, actually beat her there, is going to be a pretty big challenge for him, because Pennsylvania has lots of demographic advantages that favor the former first lady. It's an older state. It's got one of the highest average ages in the country, and she tends to do better among the older voters than he does. It's got a lot of the same sort of white working class voters with some of the same economic concerns that she did so well among in Ohio last month. So it's going to be a tall order for Senator Obama to beat her in Pennsylvania, but probably not impossible. He's running a spectacular campaign, as everybody knows. He's got a lot of money, and he still has a little bit of time. He's got a little bit more than a week to get his message out, so we'll see.
Speaking of money, John Yearwood, there's articles today both in the LA Times and in the New York Times about Obama, and particularly in Philadelphia, and what those articles refer to as street money, a sort of financial patronage system that you would think Obama would be familiar with coming from Chicago, as he does. But the issue seems to be that he is unwilling, at least publicly stated, to provide this kind of $10, $20, $30, $40 payment to people to work the streets for him in Philadelphia. Do you think that could be a factor in how well he does in Pennsylvania?
To some extent, it could, Tony, but it seems that Obama is doing so well, I think, on his own. I'm not quite sure how much of an impact that would have on his campaign and whether. I think where the race is really going to be won, not as much in Philadelphia, because there is a school of thought out there that says that if you look at Philadelphia, he may win Philadelphia. But if you look in the other, out in the other parts of the state, the rural areas, where Hillary is strongest, that may be the area where you may see a lot of the rural voters come out for Hillary to at least to sustain a win for her. But
Tony, if I could just jump into it, the suburbs are really the area that's going to be the big test for Senator Obama. The suburbs of Philadelphia, the suburbs of Pittsburgh, as opposed to downtown, where even if he's not giving out the walking around money, his vote is likely to be very strong compared with hers.
Oh, okay. And I see also there's supposed to be a difference between, let's say, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh in terms of the electorate in both those places. Is that more to the point that you were about to make, John?
Yes. And, the main thing, even going on beyond that, Tony, I mean, everyone believes that regardless of what happens in Pennsylvania, certainly, depending, the conventional wisdom right now is that Clinton will win Pennsylvania. If that happens, certainly the race goes on. And where it goes from there.
Well, let me interrupt you.
It's a big question.
Let me stop you to ask you that, because I think some people think that there's a question about that. Does she have to win in Pennsylvania by a certain margin in order for her to go on?
If it's real close, I think if you look at polls in the states that follow, many of them are very favorable to her campaign. And there is a feeling that if you look at what happens next, that she stands a good chance of doing better down the road. And she said a few weeks ago that she's going all the way to the convention. Now, no one really expects that to happen ultimately, because even Howard Dean is talking about a resolution by the beginning of July. But all indications are that the race will go on. Indeed, even the Clintons were saying that they're not quitters.
Well,
we will get a resolution. My feeling that we will get a resolution by the middle of June, beginning of July or so.
Let me bring Aaron in. Do you buy that the Clintons are in it to the end, win it or not?
Well, fortunately, I think that's true. But I agree with your point about according to the map that I've read. Clinton really has to win in Pennsylvania by a double-digit margin, and if not, it's really over. I don't know how likely that will happen at this point. The gap has been narrowing, as you pointed out, and if she wins by under 10 points, the question will become, will she just keep going, even though it's very, very, very unlikely, if not impossible, that she will win. And then we're back to the superdelegates.
Certainly. And what if she wins really big in Pennsylvania? What does that do to the race? And if it's a landslide, let's say.
Well, she will certainly go on. I guess, the odds are better that she could win not great. I don't think that puts her neck and neck with Obama. But it's certainly would compel her to keep going and, up until the convention. And there are a lot of people hoping that won't happen, because the Democrats simply have to choose a nominee and get on with the act, with the task of convincing people that we need to elect a Democrat for president.
Well, we won't have to
wait. Tony,
very
if
long.
I can say,
sir, go
if
ahead,
I can say really quick,
really quickly.
If I can say really quickly, I don't think that it will go up to the convention, but I think everyone who has looked at Democratic campaigns so far can agree on one thing: that in state after state, Democrats have outpaced Republicans in terms of the number of Democrats voting, and indeed in the number of Democrats raising money.
That's where we got to stop it, John. Unfortunately, our time has run out. I appreciate it, though. We've been speaking with Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, Beth Fooey, and John Yearwood, World Editor of the Miami Herald, who joined us from member station WLRN. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Yesterday, we heard how the dream of owning a home has soured for some. Today, we're going to take a look at the flip side. After you've bought that new house, What can you do to maximize your investment, even in today's bleak economy? Joining me now are two people with distinct views on the subject. Eric Tyson, co-author of Home Buying for Dummies and author of several books on personal finance, and Sophia Edwards, a homeowner in Hartford, Connecticut, who still lives in her first home. She bought it almost 5 years ago and presumably still enjoys living in it. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you.
Well, Sophia, let me begin with you very briefly. What do you think are the keys to smart home ownership? I mean, making the most of your investment.
I think being smart and making the most of your investment is to have goals and have dreams, and knowing that you have to educate yourself after purchasing that home, and knowing that you want to keep that home and that you cannot keep up with the Joneses. So for me, I have to live within my means and set my priorities.
You know, Eric, the word dream is often associated with home ownership. And sometimes, many times, homeowners find that their dream house turns into a nightmare if they don't handle things correctly. What is the biggest mistake new homeowners make after they get those keys?
Well, you know, after you've made this significant purchase, you've got the financial obligation of the house, and sometimes folks who haven't, you know, run the numbers, been analytic about looking at how much house they can really afford, find that they're being pinched and squeezed, and they get in the house and they have desires to make it look better, so they want to paint some rooms, they want to go out and get new furniture, and you know, more changes lead to more desires to spend money. And before you know it, people are starting to run up credit card debt or have other financial problems. So I think one of the biggest problems that I see are folks that have trouble living within their means, given the significant change that occurs in their personal finance situation when they buy a house.
Well, they certainly do want to improve their house to make it look as good, if not better, than the other houses on the street or in the neighborhood. And Sophia, I'm going to come to you about this, because you say that you've done about $35,000 worth of repairs on your property. Now, I understand that you live in a historic home located in a changing downtown neighborhood. You redid the exterior, pulled up the floors, laid new carpet, tons of electrical work, which old houses almost always have. And yet, Sophia, you did it without spending a lot of cash. How did you do that?
For me, we looked within ourselves, and we stayed on our path, which was important. Some of the things that we did, we collaborated with other people that we felt that had our that share the same dreams and goals that we have, and not wanting to get in, you know, a lot of expense. So what we did is like to ask other people that goes to our church that, you know, okay, we're doing this project, can you help me with this? Or negotiating with someone else. I mean, negotiating with the contractor. Like, for example, one of the things that when we first came into the home, we needed to do the floor. What we did, we negotiated with the contractor by asking, what about if we do the labor as far as taking out the carpet, taking up the nails, and whatever he needed to do? So therefore, we balanced it out with the time and money. We were the time, we put in the sweat equity, and then we had to, you know, pay him the money. But then it really was less for us on our pocket, because we knew what we were able to afford, and we came to the table and negotiated with him and said, this is what we have, but what about if we put in this sweat equity?
Now, you had already put money into buying the house. Did you have to get a separate loan to pay for that, even with the sweat equity that you provided?
No, we had already had some funds at that time, and so that was what we had available to pay the contractor.
Eric, how would you advise people who want to use home improvements as a way to increase the value of their homes? For example, when is renovation not a good thing?
Well, one thing you certainly don't want to do is you don't want to make your home the most expensive home on the block. Generally speaking, that's not a good financial move. Also, you know, spend money on things that will help the maintenance and upkeep of your home, that not only make it look good, but that will prevent future expenses down the road. If you're, for example, if your roof needs replacing, don't continue to put that off year after year and then instead focus on cosmetic things, because if you put off the roof replacement, leaky roof can lead to other problems in the home, and you can end up with a lot of mold and mildew and damaged wall boards and things like that. Also, make sure you understand how the tax laws work. Now, in Sophia's case, because she lives in a historic neighborhood, there are some tax breaks in the tax code, which are generally not well understood or known, that if you spend money on certain types of renovations in these historic urban neighborhoods, you may be able to qualify for some special tax deductions and credits.
How important, Eric, is it to know how long you intend to stay in a house before you start spending on and for that house?
Well, it's a good question because you don't want to overextend yourself. I generally advise that people need to ideally have at least a 5-year time horizon when they buy a house, and the reason is that there are significant transaction costs involved in buying and selling a home: real estate agent commissions, title insurance, loan fees, all those sorts of things. And you know, if you look at the round trip transaction, the purchase of a home and then ultimately the sale of that same home, these transaction costs can gobble about 15% of the value of a house. So therefore, you really need to be in a home 5, maybe as long as 7 years to get enough appreciation to recoup those costs. And as we're seeing in many, but not all, many parts of the country right now, housing prices can go through periods where the prices go down as well as go up.
Well, Sophia, how long are you planning to stay in your house? And does that have any bearing at all on what you're willing to do to it and how much money you're willing to invest in it?
Well, I do love my neighborhood that I live in. I grew up in Hartford, although I'm originally from Jamaica. I do plan on staying there because right now moving or selling our home is not a priority right now because we have a senior that's going to be going to college in September. So we will be there for a while, and we do have an 8-year-old that we feel that I have a commitment to my community, and I want her to be able to grow up in the Hartford community.
You know, Eric, Sophia mentioned something that's really interesting and important to our conversation, and I want to address it to you because historically African Americans have found it harder to buy homes, in part because of discrimination, but also because of other issues. And that's changing nowadays in some respects because more blacks have financial assets to pass on to their children and to help them invest in real estate. What do you recommend to someone who is inheriting wealth and wants to put that wealth into a home?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that certainly is an excellent use of, you know, if you're in a family where your folks or grandparents or someone, benevolent uncle is willing to help you out. I can't think of a better way to use that money, to invest the money over the long term. Real estate is a terrific investment, and that's something that I think some people, you know, perhaps lose sight of during a period like we're in right now. Because if you're in an area where housing prices are going down, and you know they may have already gone down 5, 10, 15%, it's kind of depressing. You know, especially if you bought your home in the last couple of years. But it's important to remember that over your adult life, you're going to own a home for decades, and over the decades, real estate is a proven winner. You know, the people who lose money are the folks that are forced into selling in a depressed market, and that sometimes happens. It's certainly happening with some of the foreclosures that are happening. But I think putting money into a home as a down payment, I think is an excellent long term investment.
I'd like to follow that point up with you with this, and this is a little tough question, I think, because housing in America is segregated generally by people who choose to segregate, and you have people who pick areas to buy homes based on a lot of factors, many of which have nothing to do with the house itself sometimes. My question is, when buying a house, to what extent do you take into consideration who you're living with as opposed to how that house is likely to appreciate in value down the road, if it means taking you out of a neighborhood or out of a community that you perhaps are comfortable with?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question, and you raise a point which sometimes people don't really think enough about or do enough research. And I think it's important in any neighborhood or community that you're contemplating living in to go spend time in those communities. You know, if it has a community center, go spend time there. Spend time walking around the neighborhoods. And sometimes people get so caught up in the process of shopping for a house that they become very house-focused and not community-focused. And the people that you're going to be living with, that your children will be going to school with, will have an enormous impact on your satisfaction. And you know, you should be aware of what's out there and be thoughtful about you know, what kind of a community do you want to grow up in? Do you want to raise your children in? If you have children, you absolutely should go visit the schools, spend time in the schools, talk to people there, you know, and spend less time, you know, shopping among dozens of homes and more time actually in the community thinking about these issues.
So for you, Sophia, in terms of being in the house now and what you are investing in it and what you will invest in it in the future, how much does the community that you have chosen to live in play a role in how much money you are willing to put into your house?
I'm not sure right now because I know that although I know Hartford is being developed, but at the same time, if the tax continues to go up, I'm not sure if it's something that we can probably financially bear. But I would have to see as the economy forecast of the economy. So I'm not really sure where we would be with that, to be honest with you.
All right, Eric, you mentioned.
I just wanted to say, I think it's important, and I appreciate the gentleman saying something about more shopping for your community instead of the house. But I know that I live in Hartford. I was raised in Hartford, and if I am, for example, I have a master's in social work. But if I leave my community and everyone that is now professional leaves their community, what do we leave with? We're left with nothing. And so I need to be a part of that to help to build up my community. You know, one family at a time can build a community. And for me, I am committed to that. And that's why I love where I live. Maybe, like, for example, when we were looking for a home, it took about a year and a half. Some people said to me, Sophia, go to the suburb. But I know that I believe in my community, so it was okay for me to continue searching until I find the home that I wanted to live in. Right across from our home, it's a park. Down the street, there's a school. But to me, it was that I needed to be the person that was willing to build my community one family at a time.
Well, Eric, the things that she is mentioning, that Sophia is talking about, all have an impact on the value of a property. And you've mentioned that the current slump in housing values gives people who want an opportunity to trade up a rare chance to do so. Trading up, let's tell the audience exactly what that means and why this is an opportunity right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's many, many potential buyers out there. They're the first-time buyers, and there's people who already own a home who, you know, for example, maybe their first property they bought was quite small. Maybe they bought it when they didn't have any kids, and now they have a growing family. It's more important to them, for example, to live in a community that has a certain type of school system. So, you know, trading up simply mean that you're in a financial situation where you could spend more money on a house, either in a community that has better schools or a larger home. The trade up market in many areas is more depressed than is the entry level market. So for folks that are in the position, and look, a lot of people aren't, but for the people who are in a position financially to be able to afford to spend more money in a home, the depressed market provides an opportunity. And I think it also provides an opportunity for people who are renting, who are looking for an entry point, because not only have home prices gone down, but so have interest rates. And those two things together are leading to pretty significant reductions in the cost of purchasing a home.
Would you be in favor of home equity lines of credit for homeowners?
Well, you know, once you're in a home and you have a mortgage on the property, you know, the question comes back to what can you afford? And you really have to look at your monthly spending, your monthly budget, you know, your future goals, whether it's saving for retirement or helping to pay for a portion of your kids' college costs, and ask yourself, you know, can you afford to take out more debt on your house? Some people, of course, have gotten into trouble doing that over time and used up the equity in their homes and ended up with too much debt. And in the worst cases, they've ended up with their homes in foreclosure.
I'm going to bring the conversation to a close with you, Sophia, around this. In the introduction, I said you'd been in your home about 5 years, and I said presumably you still like it, do you?
I still love our house.
And can you say, does ownership really feel that much different than renting? And is it a better feeling for you?
Oh, yes. It is such a better feeling because living in Hartford, the area where I lived at, we didn't have a backyard for our daughters to play in. And now that we have our own home, they can be able to play. They can ride their bike in the yard. They can see the beautiful landscape that we have really created and developed on our property. So it feels really great. But I think what I really want to say is that for me, it feels good, but it also feels even greater for me to be disciplined and to continue in educating myself and ourselves to making sure that we keep the home. Continuing education. For example, I attend
I'm sorry to end you there, but our time has just run out. It was very interesting to hear it, and good luck with you and your property. Eric and Sophia, both of you, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you so much.